Now at the Home Depot, save up to 35% off appliance special buys. Like the Samsung Stainless Steel Side-by-Side Refrigerator, just $9.98. You save $300. It's big enough to hold 25 bags of groceries. Unload those, and if that makes you thirsty, you'll really love the external ice maker and water dispenser. Today is the day for doing. Spring Black Friday savings now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. See store for details, valid through April 17th.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about infertility. Today, we're going to be talking about a topic I am really fascinated by, and that is how our microbiome, the microbiome of our reproductive tract, affects our fertility. A topic that's actually been in the news a lot as of late, and that I'm, as I said, really fascinated by. Hope you are as well. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am the director of Creating a Family, and we are the National Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit. And you can find us and all of our resources at our website, creatingafamily.org. This show is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring has a free program they want you to know about, My Fertility Navigator. This program offers free one-on-one support for women who are struggling to get pregnant and are at the point where they really don't know what their next step should be. Once you enroll in My Fertility Navigator, you will receive personalized guidance from a live, dedicated fertility navigator. And that person can provide you information about fertility in general, as well as a list of nearby fertility centers, information about financial resources, and just a lot of other questions you might have. You can get information at their website, myfertilitynav.com. In addition to having Ferring as our underwriter, we also have other partners who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, accurate, medically accurate information to the patient community. And some of our wonderful partners include IntegraMed Fertility. They are the largest network of fertility practices in the country, and they combine the latest innovations in reproductive science with compassionate and customized care treatment plans. So anyway, they are able to provide the best possible care by combining these two things. Also, we have Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to having clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of the prospective sperm donor. And this way, they can provide their clients with a personalized catalog of safer donor matches. Today, we're going to be talking about the human microbiome and how it affects our fertility. The microbiome exists throughout our reproductive tract in places that I was really even unaware that we had microbiome. Of course, we would assume that the vagina and other areas would have bacteria and other microbiomes existing. But they also exist other places as well throughout both the male and the female reproductive tract. Today we're going to be talking with Dr. Jason Ferdasiak. He is a reproductive endocrinologist with RMA New Jersey. And we will also be talking with Dr. Erin Wolf. She is a former assistant clinical investigator with the National Institute of Health, where she did research on this topic. This is a show that we recorded 2 years ago. It is continuing to be relevant. I read about the impact of the human microbiome on all aspects of our life in the current media. So we wanted to bring you this show again. It was incredibly well received the first time, and I think you will find it just as fascinating now. I hope you enjoy. Welcome, Dr. Wolf and Dr. Ferdasiak, to Creating a Family.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dawn. Thank you.
All right. I want to start by making sure we've got our terms correct here. So, Dr. Wolf, what is the human biome? I know it's microbes, bacteria, yeast, and other things, but could give us just kind of a basic understanding of what we're talking about.
So the microbiome is all of the organisms that live in or around, within the or on the human body. So it can be bacteria or yeast or organisms such as that. We are most familiar with them in the gut.
I was going to come that. Think of it primarily in the gut, in the intestines. But we also know that the vagina has a biome. But what other places in the body do we have large populations of beneficial bacteria or microbes? Dr. Farnasiak?
Well, you know, Dawn, it's interesting. I think that the microbiome is so much more pervasive than we had thought it was. And much of this has come about with some of the new technologies, which I hope we'll get the chance to talk about, for identifying these bugs and where they are. The human body actually contains tenfold more bacterial cells than it does human cells. So actually, you and I are made up more of microbes than we are of our own cells. And it's estimated that we may actually be carrying around 2 to 6 pounds of bugs. And so these organisms live kind of throughout the body. The oropharynx and the GI tract, gastrointestinal tract, is the most common parts, but as you mentioned, certainly large amounts live on the skin and then the reproductive tract as well.
We're talking about the microbiome, and I think we're going to probably be talking a little bit about the intestinal and gut microbiome, but I want to start by talking about the vaginal microbiome. So we intuitively understand that there are microbes in the vagina. Does it also, do these microbes extend up the reproductive tract, or are they only found in the vagina? Dr. Wolf?
So we used to think that the up higher above the vagina, so the cervix or in the cavity of the uterus or in the endometrium, was a sterile environment, but with recent literature that we've conducted, as well as others, it's been shown now that surprisingly, there is bacteria that exists in the endometrium under normal circumstances.
This may be a dumb question, but how do we know it's normally there, and how do we know it's not been there by how we're investigating it, or if it's being, you know, if it's through fertility treatment that it's been introduced as part of the egg retrieval or whatever? How do we know it's naturally there and not something that we have done? Dr. Wolf?
So that's a very good question. The more we learn about the study of the microbiome in various parts of the body, we understand how important the exact controls are, what you're saying. So we want to make sure that it's not an accident that we're seeing what we're seeing. And obviously, you're picking up on a really important point to study the lining of the uterus, which is very protective, and you have to get through the cervix and through the vagina, where we know has a high load of normal bacteria that live there. We want to make sure that what we're studying is not a contamination that's just being introduced. So one of the approaches that we took when I was at NIH is to study healthy controls, so people that don't have a reproductive problem, and to test their endometrium. And then also it's important to compare it to the patient's cervix and vagina to make sure that there isn't, it's not just solely due to contamination.
Okay. So we know that there's healthy microbes, bacteria, in the vagina. When they get out of whack and the balance is not good, is that what we call bacterial vaginosis, Dr. Farnasiak?
Yes, bacterial vaginosis would be, or vaginitis would be the term that is utilized to talk about or describe a alteration in the normal microbes that exist in and around the vagina. And it is estimated by the Centers for Disease Control that, you know, approximately 30% of the population may exhibit this. And so I think it's good to make a distinction between this alteration in normal ecosystem or bacterial vaginosis and things that we typically think about in terms of infections like sexually transmitted infections, which kind of are in a separate category in terms of the thought process, although that doesn't mean that this alteration in the normal ecosystem doesn't have some health consequences.
Yeah, and I read a study in preparation for this show that said that among certain populations of African American women, the prevalence was greater than 60%. Have you seen that as well?
I have seen that study, and there is actually some fairly good evidence that there is alterations in the normal ecosystem in the vagina, and there are several factors which are at work. Some of them are simply age-related, and some of that has to do just simply with estrogen content in and around the body. Some of it has to do with ethnic background, and it has been shown that there are different ecosystems based upon different ethnicities. And some of that information, I think, is a little bit challenging to understand. Does that mean that there are different populations or different groups of people that have different, quote-unquote, normal ecosystems, or do these alterations actually exist at higher rates in different patient populations? So I think that there are certainly some other factors.
Interesting. Okay, that is really fascinating, especially with the ethnic variations, but I guess that underlines that what healthy balance is not the same for every person. We all have our own balance, and that there's variation in what is normal. Is that a takeaway from what you just said?
There are, within reason. I think that is a very logical explanation, and there have been some studies that have been out there that describe different subsets of normal. By and large, all of these are fairly dominated by the lactobacillus species, but within that group, there are several organisms which may dominate over the other and still be kind of considered in the normal realm.
Okay. So what are the symptoms of an unbalanced microbiome in the vaginas? And I don't know if we have to make that, if we also have to make the distinction of do the symptoms change once it reaches the level of bacterial vaginitis. Dr. Wolf, so let's talk about symptoms right now.
Well, one way to diagnose bacterial vaginosis is using AMSL criteria. And this is a checklist that you have to have at least three things of either homogeneous, thin, grayish white discharge, a vaginal acid pH level greater than 4.5, something called a positive amine test. You can also use it with potassium hydroxide to do this test, and also a special type of cell that we see on the microscope called a clue cell. So of those four things, if you have three, then using AMSL's criteria, then you would be diagnosed with BV. What's interesting is that a lot of people have sort of noticed that some women seem to have meet the criteria for BV by when you use culture-based methods. So if you take a sample and try and grow the bacteria in an incubator, then they would be detecting some of the species that are associated most commonly with bacterial vaginosis, but the patient wasn't symptomatic and it didn't bother her. So we now that we're able to use these advanced molecular techniques and really see all of the bacteria that's there, not just culturing for one or two specific types, are now able to understand why these women, those microbes are just there normally for those women, and that they probably do just have a normal vaginal microbiome.
So is it possible to have your microbiome be imbalanced, but to have no symptoms? Or am I understanding you that if you have no symptoms, then it might be that that's just normal for you and is not considered an imbalance?
Well, it's more the way that the older techniques of diagnosing it were to look for a specific type of bacteria, and then we would say that person might have have bacterial vaginosis, but it didn't totally make sense because we knew that the patients didn't notice anything wrong with them. And now when we can test using a different way, we see that this is probably a healthy environment overall when we can see all the different species at one time. And that just having that one specific microbe that we can test for doesn't mean that they have bacterial vaginosis. So as we alluded to a little bit at the beginning, the reason why this area of research has sort of exploded is because we were so limited in the way we could test and understand what was happening in different parts of the body. And it was sort of like looking under a lamppost to see what you could find. And now we can sort of see very broadly what's going on using these new techniques.
All right. So what could a woman look for? Now, she's not yet gone to the doctor because of the checklist. And you call that, what was the name of that checklist?
AMSLS criteria.
Okay. AMSLS criteria. That's something, much of those are things that would a doctor would have to, she would have to go to a doctor to have the test run. But from a woman's standpoint, what would she notice on her own that would indicate to her, I better go to the doctor and see if this is going to be a problem?
And it would mostly be a vaginal discharge, and the classic type of vaginal discharge that's associated with bacterial vaginosis is sort of a clear, watery, or grayish discharge compared to different types of discharge that you can have with other conditions.
Okay. Yeah, and that would be a distinction between that versus a yeast infection or other type of infections, which would have just normal cervical mucus. So that would be a change and a distinction in the type of discharge. Okay.
That's right. And what's interesting when you take care of patients is sometimes normal ovulation throughout the cycle is a healthy sign of a change in cervical discharge. So sometimes women are not able to distinguish between healthy cervical discharge and something that might be concerning. And sometimes that also comes up because when you're on the birth control pill, you're not seeing those fluctuations going through the cycle each month,
and
it's just continuous. And then when you come off the birth control pill, for many women, this is the first time that they've noticed that there are these fluctuations that change.
Such a good point. Yeah, absolutely. And that's easy to then confuse if you've not had the typical cycle of cervical mucus, that you might not recognize that what's normal and what is unusual if you've been on the pill for a long time. Good point.
Right.
Okay, Dr. Frasniak, I want to talk about now the impact of the vaginal biome, imbalance or out of balance, and how that affects fertility. And I guess we could divide that into kind of three general areas that I want to ask about. One is, how does it impact the sperm getting to the egg? Because in normal conception, a healthy or an unhealthy microbiome.
Absolutely. So I think that when we're talking about the microbiome and the reproductive tract, again, sometimes important to distinguish between some of the more traditionally or known pathogens which cause alterations in the microbiome, and then some of the more subtle ones that we're really just learning about. So there are certainly bacteria that we know very well, things like Mycobacterium tuberculosis, chlamydia, or gonorrhea, and those microbes can cause infections which can ascend up into the uterus and out into the fallopian tubes, and they can actually cause significant scarring, and that scarring serves to cause problems with transport of sperm out to the eggs, and then once fertilization has occurred, the embryo which is forming then back into the uterus. And so there are some certainly very well-known issues that arise when it comes to that inflammatory environment and problems with transport of the sperm and the embryo, as well as implantation due to the changes in the inflammatory environment due to the infection inside of the uterus and fallopian tube.
Yeah, and those are, I was going to try to make a distinction, and you've already done it, between the actual sperm meeting the egg and then the implantation. And it sounds like, and then the last one is carrying a pregnancy to term. But it sounds like that some of the well-known, I guess those will probably all be sexually transmitted bacterial imbalances, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and the one that was a type of tuberculosis, did you say?
It was, yeah. The Mycobacterium tuberculosis, I don't know, would kind of typically, although it can infect the pelvis, not necessarily fall in that kind of classic sexually transmitted infection group.
Okay.
But the other two certainly would and do have known impact on fertility and success with being able to both conceive and then carry a pregnancy forward.
Okay, so and that's because of the inflammation and scarring that would impact the ability of the sperm to meet the egg naturally, and then for the embryo to implant. So what about others? Now those are specific diseases, but what about just a general imbalance? More bacteria that's not specific to one of those diseases, or something else that's not directly affiliated with a disease that we know of. Does that impact the sperm getting the conception or implantation?
There is a distinct possibility that it may, and I think I certainly want to talk about some of the details, but I think that some of this is kind of a stay tuned answer. So I really do believe that the microbiome has some pretty direct impacts. And there are some good studies out there. In fact, there's studies looking at both men and women. So there are some association studies that have looked at kind of quote-unquote healthy groupings of bacteria. And in men and women, it's fairly similar, actually kind of lactobacillus dominant. And in men who don't have this kind of dominant environment by these quote-unquote normal or healthy bacteria, they actually have alterations in the sperm parameters. So when you look at the sperm underneath the microscope, these men have higher instances of sperm that don't move well, or higher instances of low sperm counts. They have higher instances of white blood cells, or indicators that perhaps inflammation is going on in their reproductive tract. And so there is some potential there that some of these things are having a negative impact on the male side of things, and that's normal sperm production.
Let me ask you a question here. So are we talking about with males their gut microbiome, that in their intestines, or do men also have microbiomes or microbes in their reproductive tract?
No, this is the microbes in the male reproductive tract, not the male GI tract.
Okay. So there's some evidence both for males and females that an imbalance that's not even associated with a specific disease that we know of can influence or lower the ability for conception as well as for implantation. But yet, as you said, this is an area that's currently under investigation, so we don't know a whole lot of detail. Is that a good interpretation of what you said?
Yes, Dawn. I mean, I think that's a very accurate description. I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges comes with some of the things that we have spoken with and Dr. Wolf's alluded to already, and that is that, you know, the evaluation of some of these environments, which are kind of challenging to get to in a way that allows us to really directly analyze them without bringing along with our method of analysis bugs that are from other parts of the reproductive tract. Sometimes it can be challenging to really accurately determine, to start with, what is normal and abnormal. And then if you can accurately kind of determine normal and abnormal, the next step really down the road, and this is kind of the holy grail in this field, is can you alter abnormal, make it normal, and improve outcomes?
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to move towards that because that's something that I also really want to focus on as well. All right, now we've talked about conception and implantation. I'd like to shift now to how the microbiome might affect the ability of a woman to carry a pregnancy to term. Dr. Wolf, if a woman has either vaginosis or just a severely disrupted microbiome, is there any evidence that that would increase her risk of preterm delivery, miscarriage, anything along those lines?
Yes, we know that alterations in the vaginal, we know a lot more in general about the vaginal microbiome and how it affects pregnancy than we do about the endometrium and how it affects fertility. So there have been very large multi-center studies looking at the effects and of the vaginal microbiome on obstetrical outcomes, and this was really important work because along the way in doing research in this area, for instance, we tried things like treating women with bacterial vaginosis because we knew that they were at higher risk for certain adverse obstetrical outcomes, and it actually made things worse. So we're hoping that in the infertility field that we're going to be able to get to that step by understanding it better and knowing the best way to treat it.
So why does a vaginal imbalance result in a greater risk, a significantly greater risk for preterm birth?
One of the theories is that, well, we know that the women with bacterial vaginosis are at higher risk of other infections, other reproductive tract infections, sexually transmitted infections, and that maybe the bacteria that live there alter the environment, which make it easier for bad bacteria to go higher. So it could be the similar effect with pregnancy, and that the bad bacteria then are able to grow and survive and then go up into the pregnancy and cause inflammation and then cause preterm contractions and labor.
Okay. Dr. Farnesiak, are there any ramifications that are known for the children who are born to a woman who had vaginosis or a disrupted biome during her pregnancy?
You know, there are, to my knowledge, no really solid links to some of the childhood or developmental outcomes. One of the most challenging things with any of this would be if that child was born as a result of, a preterm labor and delivery. There are so many other confounding issues which come about as a result of delivering a child preterm that it would be very challenging to directly tie it to the alteration in that vaginal microbiome.
Yes,
so
such
I think
a good
that
point.
There are certainly some interesting aspects to the concept, although I don't know that we're there just yet with that vaginal infection directly correlating with the developmental problems in children.
Is there a correlation between vaginitis, vaginosis, and I'll probably mispronounce this, chorioamnionitis, which, as I understand it, is an inflammation of the placenta during pregnancy, and I may have that wrong. So, Dr. Farnesiak, tell me if I've got it wrong, and do you know if is there a correlation? Because I know that that can result in some significant potential issues for children who whose mother had that during their pregnancy.
No, you said it just right. It's chorioamnionitis, and it's just a general term, which is an inflammation of the membranes that surround and protect the developing child. And there's been a lot of association studies that try to determine whether or not there are links to these different types of infections. And we do see, as a result of the bacterial vaginosis infections, as Dr. Wolf had talked about, that there's a link to preterm labor and delivery. And in those studies, they often will look and note that chorioamnionitis or an inflammation of those membranes exists, which is oftentimes part and parcel with a preterm delivery. The challenging thing has been whether or not there has been, interventions which actually prevent or treat that. And as we talked about with Dr. Wolf, those studies have not proven to be as intuitive as we might have thought that they would be. you know, I think that one of the interesting, really fascinating areas for me is, you know, we talked a lot about the vaginal microbiome, but the human microbiome in general and its impact on pregnancy is another interesting link. Some of the most fascinating studies about the placental microbiomes, looking at the essentially the organ which nourishes the developing child, you look at the placental microbiome, and the majority of the normal bugs found in the placental microbiome actually come from the mouth, which tells us that these bugs actually travel through the blood to the placenta, and has led a pretty significant charge to oral hygiene and oral care during pregnancy as a mechanism by which we may decrease the rates of preterm birth and delivery.
That is absolutely fascinating. So the placenta has its own microbiome, and it is established, the bacteria that is established there primarily comes from the mouth, or the digestive, or the mouth. I guess it would be the mouth. It wouldn't be the gut. It would be the mouth. That's fascinating.
Yeah, some of the foremost researchers in the world that are looking at that have found that, and it's a very interesting finding.
And so when we come in later in the show, when we start talking about what we can do to improve our microbiome if we're considering conception, one of the things is oral hygiene. And I would assume that, you know, oral hygiene really means brushing your teeth. Is that what we're saying?
It does. And then, you know, regular visits to the dentist to ensure that there aren't any infections or cavities. But I think that, you know, it's intuitive that we would all want to have good oral hygiene. But this is a really interesting and very different bent scientifically as to why that is actually so impactful, rather than just thinking intuitively, well, it would be good to have, you know, good oral hygiene.
Yeah, you know, if for no other reason that, you know, bad breath and all the other things that really aren't that important. Yeah. Well, you know, that's an interesting thing. And I also, we've been talking about vaginal and now introducing the placental microbiome. But Dr. Wolf, does the intestinal microbiome affect fertility? And one way I would imagine would be weight, because we know that certainly weight is an important factor in fertility in general. And there's at least some evidence, I think, isn't there, that a disturbed gut biome will make you more likely to gain weight?
Yes, so we know a lot more about the gut microbiome and its effect on health. And also a lot about the vaginal microbiome and some of its effects on symptoms in women. But the infertility aspect really is a little bit of an unknown and an active area of research. And I think it's because it's such a complex organ. It changes every month. It goes through the same sets of genes to develop like it did when it was developing in utero. And it's highly influenced by hormones, by change, by age, by other factors, intercourse. And it just makes it very difficult to study. And we didn't even know that it had normal microbiome in it until the past few years. And we thought that any microbes that were there were only there in the setting of infection or pathologic infection. So we don't have that answer yet to know whether it affects infertility or not.
So do we have any research that would indicate that women with either, I guess, an unhealthy intestinal microbiome are more likely to have fertility problems? Is there any evidence, is there any research that would indicate that?
Not that I'm aware of. No.
Okay. Yeah, that's an area to be developed. Dr. Farnesiak, do you know of any any correlation between the gut or intestinal dysregulation in the biome and its potential impact on fertility?
You know, Don, I'm not directly aware of research which would tie it so cleanly. You know, as Dr. Wolf indicated, that's an area of active research. You know, as a fundamental or a theoretical basis for it, I do know that there is data out there which looks during pregnancy at the GI microbiome, and it actually changes its profile if you look and compare between the first trimester and the third trimester. And the entire aspect of labor and delivery is a kind of physiologic or what we would call normal inflammatory cascade, which eventually results in a normal labor and delivery. And it just seems so intuitive to me that given how integral we know our microbiome is to the inflammatory state of the body, that, you know, even the microbiome changes from the first to third trimester may actually have some kind of normal role in this onset of parturition. And if that is indeed the case, I think that there is very good theoretical basis and evidence for these additional studies that are coming out that we may very well find a role for the GI microbiome or other microbiomes for that matter when it comes to successful reproduction. But, you know, as Dr. Wolf said, certainly do not want to overstate any of those findings as it stands right now.
You are listening to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. Today we're talking about the microbiome and fertility. We primarily keep in touch through our weekly e-newsletters. We have one a week on infertility. We let you know about the latest developments as well as the upcoming week's Creating a Family show topic. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter at any page of creatingafamily.org, top right side. All right, I want to move now to talking about what causes a disturbance of the healthy, and we'll primarily be talking about the vaginal biome, microbiome. What are some of the typical causes? I mean, does diet, can our diet affect what's growing in our vagina? Is that a possibility, and whether so or not, what are some of the other causes, Dr. Wolf?
Our diet can certainly affect our gut microbiome. The vaginal microbiome, I don't believe, is as affected by our diet as the gut is, and we still don't have any information about how it might be affected in the endometrial lining.
Gotcha. And we haven't even mentioned that there is a microbiome in the endometrial lining. Did I understand you correctly that is the case, that there are endometrial biomes as well?
Right, yes. We used to think that it was a sterile environment in order for the endometrium to be healthy and for the uterus to be healthy, and it was only there, for instance, if there was a pelvic inflammatory disease or sexually transmitted disease like gonorrhea or chlamydia. But recent evidence has shown that there is bacteria in the endometrium and that it's not a sterile environment, even in asymptomatic women.
Okay. Dr. Farnesiak, we've gotten some questions from people about these things that they're asking. Could they affect these? Would these things be a potential cause for a disturbed vaginal microbiome? I'll just read them out, just kind of give me your opinion on the number of sexual partners.
So we do know that the intercourse or sex can impact the vaginal microbiome. The data that I am aware of, aside from increased risk for potentially sexually transmitted infections, which is clearly influenced by number of sexual partners, in terms of the vaginal microbiome, I am not aware of direct data showing that increased number of partners changes the microbiome, but given that intercourse can, in the immediate time frame, change the microbiome, that is feasible.
What about stress? That was another question we have.
Stress, I think, is something that would be interesting to think about. Whenever I think about the microbiome and its interaction with the body, certainly you think about its interaction with the immune system. There is certainly good evidence that stresses on the body can alter our immune system, which could then alter our microbiome. But I am unaware of any studies which have measured people's stress and looked at changes in their vaginal microbiome.
Okay, here's one. Vaginal piercings. Any evidence that a vaginal piercing would affect the microbiome in the vagina?
You know, in terms of
this is Dr. Farnesiak.
Oh, thank you. Yes, you know, in terms of things that this I think falls into the more broad category, even of things that we may do to or in or around the vagina, which could alter the milieu. For sure, one of the things that we see that does alter the microbiome in a potentially negative way is vaginal douching. And so cleaning of the vagina or using chemicals in and around the vagina, it assuredly alters the microbiome and is something that actually has been shown to have additional issues in regards to the outcomes for pregnancies as well. In terms of whether or not a piercing would cause a global change in the microbiome, again, I would be kind of overstepping to state that I have any direct evidence that that would cause it. But assuredly, things like vaginal douching or introduction of chemicals in and around the vagina is assuredly not advisable.
And antibiotic use, I am assuming, does impact the vaginal biome, Dr. Wolf?
That's correct. It does, significantly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what about infertility medications? The infertility medications that are commonly prescribed, either oral or injectable, the gonadotropins or any of the clomiphene citrates or letrozole, any of those, can they impact the vaginal biome, Dr. Wolf?
You know, these are all really excellent questions. For hormones in particular, we do know that some of the microorganisms that we're finding are hormonally responsive and can feed off of hormones and proliferate in the setting of hormones. So we know that there's changes that happen at the time of nearing menopause or with hormonal changes, and I have taken care of patients who've had significant changes in their microbiome in response to fertility treatments who had ovarian failure. But I think really we have so much data on the sequences, the DNA sequences of all of these microorganisms, and it's very easy and very cheap to use this new technology, and the hardest part is figuring out what it all means. And this is sort of a good example of a big data question. When you have large enough data sets and large enough power of being able to investigate these different questions, because really it's probably many different interactions. It's changes in the menstrual cycle. It's whether or not they have ovarian failure. It's whether or not they have endometriosis. It's whether or not they, you know, may or may not have vaginal piercings. These are all open questions and probably will take a big data approach to answer.
You mean by big data, you mean large-scale research where you're looking at a large number of women?
And collecting lots and lots of data points. So before we would do just one culture for one bacteria, and now we can do one swab and get terabytes of information about the bacteria that might be living. And so if we were able to follow it over time, look at differences between patients over time and differences between patient groups, then we would be able to understand really what the true effects. Is it a change in the menstrual cycle, or is it because they have some sort of a reproductive disorder or infertility, or that their husband has a change, and answer the way all of these things interact?
Okay. Now the part that I think a lot of people are quite interested in, and that is, how do we restore a healthy vaginal biome, or how do we treat a disturbed vaginal or reproductive tract biome? And I'd like to address this both from the proactive preventative measures standpoint as well as treatment options once the biome is out of whack. So let's start by talking about probiotics. And again, what both anecdotal but also what the research is showing. Dr. Farnesiak, what do we know about the use of probiotics? And then if you can distinguish between probiotics taken in a pill form versus administered vaginally versus naturally occurring in the foods we eat.
Sure, Don. Yeah, you know, I think that the again, the microbiome has, in terms of just its pervasiveness in the publicity, with the publicity it's getting, it has become a huge attraction for patients that they will go online and do these researches, and they'll try to determine what they can do in order to affect or correct an alteration in their microbiome. And the probiotics are something that typically does come up. The data surrounding them are coming out. We are seeing that there are studies that have looked at probiotics, and these are, you know, the oral probiotics or vaginal probiotics, and there have been a very small handful of very small randomized controlled trials, and some of them looked at probiotics which contain different types of lactobacilli and showed improvements in delivery rates with certain types over others. These trials are, as I said, small and need to be confirmed with much larger data sets, as Dr. Wolf had spoken about. I think that part of the challenge when it comes to conducting these types of experiments is that you have to really well define the patient population that you are looking at. And many of them will look at patients who have failed traditional therapies. And oftentimes when you look to try to make any type of change afterwards, you'll have a subset of folks who end up responding to just a second round of the more traditional therapy. And so I think that when you're looking and trying to make sense of some of these studies, that we have to pay close attention to how the patients were put into the study and then what happened to them once they were in the study.
You know, and one question I always wonder is if dietary probiotics, fermented foods, if that would have a positive, if that has a positive impact, then have there been any studies that look at cultural distinctions? Because there are certainly some countries that have where eating cultured fermented foods is just a part of their daily diet, as opposed to in the United States where that may not be the case. So, Dr. Wolf, have there been any studies that you know of that would look culturally and say we see more vaginosis, or we see more disturbed microbiomes, human microbiomes, either gut or vaginal or whatever, in the U.S. versus, say, Korea, where kimchi is a standard part of the diet?
That's a good question. I'm not aware if that's been studied extensively, and I would also look at those studies carefully to try and understand better if they do exist, if it's an underlying genetic differences in the population that may be interacting with the microbiome, or if it's true just isolated differences in the microbiome due to diet.
Yeah, that's a very good point to make that distinction. So, Dr. Frasniak, do you recommend that patients eat a specific diet, that it may help, may not help, but it wouldn't hurt, that type of thing, that focus on probiotics or prebiotics, I guess, in this case?
So I think it's an excellent question, and I always spend a significant amount of time with my patients talking with them about some of the nutritional aspects of their fertility care and just kind of well-being care. So, you know, we do know that obesity is a major issue in the country, and this is certainly impactful on fertility, and changes in the microbiome can be associated with obesity, as it does change the environment in which we exist and thus interact with our microbiome. So, in general, a healthy diet and exercise are going to be important for both decreasing the incidence of obesity, which is impactful on care, and I think that also has a healthy impact on the microbiome. In terms of specific dietary recommendations, there are certainly conditions which patients may have which would require, of course, they have specific dietary conditions parameters set forth, such as celiac disease, for example, and that certainly does have an impact on the patient's inflammatory milieu and certainly could have an impact on their fertility, and we would recommend them following good practices when it came to a gluten-free diet if that were the case for them. But beyond that, for the patients that are coming to see me kind of on their for their general infertility care, it's more of a general wellness conversation about healthy eating and good practices.
So you don't feel like the evidence is there yet to suggest focusing on increasing yogurt or fermented foods or avoiding things like sugar or things are introducing more prebiotic type foods. Am I understanding you correctly?
When it comes to that particular recommendation, certainly, you know, increasing or high sugars in the diet have other health issues, which I think are impactful and very well may be mediated or caused by alterations of the microbiome. And so I think in that regard, certainly a low sugar or a healthy balanced diet is helpful, but I do not have any strong evidence that increasing the amount of yogurt or oral probiotics that you would eat in just kind of a general sense would increase your health as it comes to reproduction.
Okay. We did get, as probably no surprise, a couple of questions talking about douching. One was from someone asking about a light vinegar vaginal douche, and the other one was talking about douching with a yogurt solution. She, in specific, was a frequent sufferer of yeast infections. So let's talk about douching in general. Dr. Farnesiak has already kind of introduced that concept. Dr. Wolf, does it matter if what you're douching with? And I think there is a belief that a slightly more acidic vagina has a healthier environment. And according to this the patient, she's wondering if that a light vinegar vaginal douche would contribute to a milieu that would be more friendly to the good bacteria.
I think that this would sort of fall into the category Dr. Farnesiak was talking about of it being the chemical substances. And it's such a broad target that it disrupts everything. And so in general, we think that for most women that this is not going to be helpful and that it is, in fact, harmful. And with regards to putting other douching for oral or for yogurt douches, I'm not familiar with exactly the effects of what that would be. I would be concerned about other components of the yogurt that could also cause alterations in the vaginal microbiome. And again, about this being sort of a situation of unintended consequences where you increase one population of microbes, but then you're harming another population, and we still are just in the early days of understanding how these all interact.
Okay, then that may answer some of these other questions, but these are some home remedies that have been suggested for vaginosis. And it was not clear from most of the comments that we received if we're talking it's not clear whether this is a douche or oral. Well, this one would have to be a douche. Hydrogen peroxide. I'll start. I think I know your answer, since I'm getting the gist here that the mantra should be let your vagina clean itself. But let me ask these just so we can, because I think these are typical things that people think about, and we certainly hear about them online. And Creating a Family runs a very large online support group, so we do hear about these things. Hydrogen peroxide, and this is for kind of home remedies for vaginosis. Dr. Farnesiak?
Yeah, Dawn, I think that some of this certainly has been covered pretty well, and I think that hydrogen peroxide would certainly fall under one of those kind of fairly caustic chemicals that would be much more far-reaching than just tackling some of the bad, quote-unquote bad bacteria that are causing
okay.
the bacterial vaginosis.
How about things like tea tree oil?
You know, I don't know of any direct studies that look at the tea tree oil. I do know that there are a pretty large population of women in the United States who suffer from chronic bacterial vaginosis. And so there's going to be a pretty long list of potential things that have been tried that will not have found their way into larger studies where we can actually look at these in a scientific or systematic way, which I think is important when it comes to the recommendations. The tea tree oil would fall into that category for me.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. You're exactly right. A large number of women do have bacterial vaginosis, and so home remedies abound. And we could probably, I'll just read off some of the others. Garlic, which I'm assuming is oral, not vaginal. Fenugreek and coconut oil. These are all typical ones that we hear. Would it be fair to say that from what you're saying, that none of these have had enough scientific evidence to say that you could recommend it, Dr. Farnesiak?
Yes, I would say that would be the case.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So now we've talked about what doesn't have good scientific support to recommend treatment. Let's shift over to talk about what treatment options are available and have been shown either to restore a healthy balance or to treat a bacterial vaginosis. Dr. Wolf, it seems counterintuitive, but I know that antibiotics are often prescribed. Is that still the case, and is it effective?
So we classically do treat bacterial vaginosis with a couple of different antibiotics. There are women that we know that this is very resistant to, and there's some emerging evidence that it might be because their specific colony of flora is a little bit different, and they have species that are just naturally more resistant to those antibiotics. And I think, you know, with any of these treatments that we're talking about, and why, you know, some bacteria or some antibiotics work for some women and why they don't work for others, or whether there's been such a list of things that some women say work and some women don't, and that we would have to be very careful with generalizing to say that it would help others, is because everyone, when we've cultured women's endometrium, it's very different from patient to patient, and I can only imagine what any of these interventions, how that would shift the flora in both the vagina and the endometrium in all of the patients that we've cultured, and I couldn't say if that would be helpful or harmful.
Well, I think isn't it true, that there's a high reoccurrence rate of vaginosis, bacterial vaginosis, with antibiotic treatment. Dr. Wolf, is that true?
So you can, antibiotic treatment for, so if we give a patient antibiotics to treat her bacterial vaginosis, then yes, there are certain women that tend to get it over and over again, and it might be because they have a specific type of bacteria that is resistant, and not in the traditional way that we think the same bacteria that gives everyone a head cold then mutates and becomes stronger against the bacteria. It's just that they have different bacteria, and that antibiotic naturally doesn't work very well towards that populations that they have in their microbiome.
So if you use an antibiotic that is specifically targeted to the reproductive tract or to the vagina, how do you then restore it's going to wipe out a large number of the microbes, the good and the bad. So how do women go back and restore a healthy microbiome in their vagina, which is the best protection against vaginosis? Dr. Wolf?
That's a really great question. So we haven't done extensive studies looking at return to normal after antibiotic treatment, but what we know from other areas of microbiome flora, like in the gut or the mouth after antibiotic treatment, that it varies a lot from patient to patient or from treatment to treatment. So some patients, their gut, after they take a course of antibiotics, will go right back to normal. Other patients, it drifts back to normal but never quite recovers. And for other patients still, it seems to be changed very long term. And we just don't have that information yet to understand what those differences are and what those normal time courses are. And there aren't a lot of great recommendations for how to return unhealthy vaginal microbiome or endometrial microbiome back to a more normal homeostasis. Now, there are pathological conditions like pelvic inflammatory disease or gonorrhea, chlamydia, things like that, and we do have antibiotics that we know work and have used for a long time to treat those really significant infections. But these subtle alterations that we're only beginning to understand, we not only don't really understand them, but as Dr. Farnesiak said at the beginning, that this is really the holy grail of what we'd like to do as doctors, is be able to understand it and then finally help someone by treating them.
And for our last question, let me come back to you, Dr. Farnesiak. So is there a downside? We had talked about probiotics. And is there a downside after a round of antibiotics for a woman to either take oral or vaginal suppositories of probiotics? Is there something that would there be a reason why she wouldn't do that in an attempt to restore a healthy balance?
No, and I'm not aware of any of the studies where they've looked at this, that there are bad outcomes, per se, that we can directly link to the probiotics. I don't know in all circumstances that they're going to be directly helpful, but I can't point to anything that states that they're going to be absolutely harmful. And, the probiotics is an area where docs are really trying hard to determine if there's a role. Antibiotics, as Dr. Wolf has said, is a pretty big stick to treat a pretty narrow thing. And we're trying our best to work towards perhaps, rather than beating back abnormal, enhancing what is normal. And there are some studies which are out there, and again, these are some of the preliminary studies which need to be looked at further, which look at antibiotic alone treatment versus antibiotic along with probiotic treatment for bacterial vaginosis. And they did show that the antibiotic and probiotic had a higher cure rate and a longer period of time without bacterial vaginosis. And so I think that there is some hope there. Is it definitive? Not yet. And so I think that some of this, some of the themes, a lot of this is, really stay tuned. There's going to be some really exciting stuff coming out in the coming couple of months and years regarding the microbiome and its interaction with health and human disease.
And that is a great, you did a great job of summing that up. And you're right, this is an area of really exciting research, and it's coinciding with an area where the patient population is also very interested in it, which I guess can make it complicated from a doctor's standpoint, whereas some research is not as of great of interest to the patient population. We certainly see a tremendous amount of interest in this topic in our online community. Thank you for joining us today for this discussion of the microbiome and fertility with Dr. Jason Farnesiak and Dr. Aaron Wolf. Let me take a moment now to thank a few more of our Gold sponsors and to remind you that it was through their generous support that we can bring you this show. We have Fairfax Cryobank. They have been a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years and are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. And we also have the law offices of James Fletcher Thompson. They are a South Carolina firm committed to assisted reproductive law as well as adoption. They also have a gestational surrogacy matching program and provide legal services for all types of independent surrogacy, egg donation, and embryo donation matters. If you have enjoyed the show, and I'm sure you have, we would really appreciate that you give us a rating on iTunes. We are the number one rated show on iTunes on this subject matter, and we'd like to keep there. It's super easy. Just pop over to iTunes and give us a star rating or give us a write a comment if you feel so inclined. Again, our guests today were Dr. Jason Farnesiak and Dr. Aaron Wolf. To get more information about Dr. Aaron Wolf, you can go to the website pronounce that again, Dr. Wolf. I don't know why I'm having such trouble with that.
Oh, no problem. It's Cellmatics.
Cellmatics. I'm going to spell it since I've screwed it up twice now. Cellmatics, CELMATIX.com, cellmatics.com. To get more information about Dr. Jason Farnesiak, you can go to the website from RMA New Jersey, which is an easy website, RMANJ.com. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
Your hands were made for greatness. Mighty hands for painting, paneling, and clicking the submit order button on HomeDepot.com to get that duvet. And these Egyptian cotton towels delivered right to your door. Do more with decor at the Home Depot. Save up to 30% on select bedding and bath. Now at HomeDepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Enter promo code BEDBATH15 at purchase for an extra 15% off. Visit HomeDepot.com for more information.
Now at the Home Depot, save up to 35% off appliance special buys. Like the Samsung stainless steel side-by-side refrigerator, just $9.98. You save $300. It's big enough to hold 25 bags of groceries. Unload those, and if that makes you thirsty, you'll really love the external ice maker and water dispenser. Today is the day for doing. Spring Black Friday savings now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only, while supplies last. See store for details, valid through April 17th.